Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, author Erica Schickel talks about her new book, The Big Hurt, and being raised by wolves.
And I suddenly realized that my mother had abandoned me. I mean, I was 45 years old before I understood that. And then I understood that my father had too, and that the Buxton School had, and that every single adult who was responsible for me had completely thrown me away. You know, I was being seen because I was a Lolita, but I could not see that. I just thought that I was being loved, you know, and of course, every time I would be tossed aside because that's not what any of those men wanted from me.
Today on the show, author Erica Schickel talks about being raised by wolves. Stay close.
Hey, it's Erica Schickel, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys had a chance to listen to the show last week with musician and now author Richard Marks. Holy cow, was that fun chatting with Richard Marks. I'll say that. He is a really nice guy. You know, he reminds me of my brother, just super laid back. But his book is very, very good. It's called Stories to Tell, and he tells stories about, you know, all of his encounters with just the most amazing people that he's collaborated with over the years. He started, you know, music like his parents were musicians, and so he grew up with it in his heart. But, I mean, by the time he was 15, he was playing with Lionel Flippin Richie. You see what I'm saying, Erica?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the guy, it's like, yeah. The music is in this guy's soul, and we had so much fun chatting. We had so much fun. His wife is Daisy Fuentes, and both of them are just like red hot on Twitter. Super fun to follow. And go back, you guys. Listen to me chatting with Richard Marks. He actually, his story is about meeting Paul Newman on several occasions, really. And so it's super fun, and go back, listen to that. But not today. Today I'm here with author Erica Schickel, and she's actually been on the show before. But it was before the moon landing. And that was for your book called You're Not the Boss of Me.
Mm-hmm. You're Not the Boss of Me. Adventures of a Modern Mom. It was a memoir.
Womp womp. I never heard that. But, you know, that was such a great book. It really was. You have so much attitude. And, you know, you had a great take on modern parenting. And you made fun of everybody. So it was fun.
Mostly myself, I hope.
Yeah, it was a great book. Is that still available, do you think?
Alas, no. My dream is that it will be republished and handsomely rejacketed at some point. But there are copies to be found out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what is kind of fun about Amazon in terms of buying a book. And you might find something. Well, that's at a bookstore, too. What the hell am I talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. The point is, You're Not the Boss of Me. That was a great book you put out several years ago. But now with the new memoir you just put out, which I know is going to be a major hit. Mm-hmm. It actually comes out today, August 10th, on Hatchet Books published it. And it's called The Big Hurt. The Big Hurt. And the cover is very beautiful. It's this really pretty, I'm trying to think the color blue it is. It's not royal blue. Mm-mm. It's not peacock blue.
Yeah, closer to peacock, but yeah, it's a beautiful color.
It's a beautiful, it's like my nail polish.
It is like your nail polish.
How about that? I'm going to go, when I go to the manicurist next, I'm going to say, what the hell is this color?
I want Big Hurt blue, please.
Well, you know what? When you start going out and doing your live, you know, when you start doing live book launches and your end shows and stuff and readings, this would be a fun choice.
Yeah, it would be.
On your nails. Wouldn't that be cute? If you had a skirt or shoes.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
I always dress to match my books.
Oh, who doesn't? Anyway, and the picture on the cover is really good. It's just a picture of you, Erica, but we don't even really know it's you. It could be any girl, a young girl giving the finger. It's in black and white. You have on round sunglasses, and it just shows a lot of attitude. Mm-hmm. And it is you. And, you know, this book, I read it over a month ago because I got a galley of it. And I wanted to talk to you so fast because it just... this book, and I read a lot, Erica. I read a really good amount, and this book just like hit me. Like, I haven't been hit by a book in years. Like, I just wanted to finish it like now. I bet I read it in three sittings, and it's just so impactful because you really do address kids who are left to fend for themselves at young ages. You know, and in The Big Hurt, it probably affected me so much because I also had a lot of, I had free rein is what I had, free rein.
Yeah.
In my own house, a lot of my audience knows this, but I'm the youngest of six, right? So a Catholic family, six kids and my parents. And, you know, as we get older, everybody leaves, right? Of course.
Sure.
When I was seven, my first sister left and then another sister and another sister and my brother. Everybody leaves, right? By the way, my one sister, Karen, who is the second oldest, she almost raised me. She was very maternal. She still is. There is a letter that I wrote her when she got married. I was nine. And it says, "Dear Karen, you did not tell me you were leaving after the wedding. And now I hear you're moving in with your husband. I didn't know this. How, you know?" And I was so upset because I didn't know my sister was leaving.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, I say, "I have to go to the bathroom, and then I'm watching Happy Days. Bye."
That is so classic. That is a classic Gen X letter right there. Nobody explained to young Christine what was going to happen after the wedding.
So then I'm 15 and my dad leaves and he moves in with his tennis partner. So we go from 8 all the way down to 3 and now there's 2, just me and my mom. Mm. And she was not present. Back then, there was no therapy. There was only one book called Passages by Gail Sheehy. And if you didn't have that book, you were really screwed.
Yeah.
And that's all my mom, you know, so she, so by 15, I was on my way to a lot of bad situations. And your book, The Big Hurt, is sort of like that. But what I find so interesting about your story is you grew up with, you know, a bit of wealth. And we're going to hear about that in your story today, Raised by Wolves. And I think that what we're both referring to is parents that for one reason or another just check out. Like my dad, until he died, he would say, "You raise a kid till they're 7 years old, and that's all you can teach them."
Great.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, that was how our parents were. That generation was, you know, it's funny because, you know, the way Raised by Wolves story is interesting because I didn't figure it out until I was in my 40s, what had happened. And so, you know, I started, my first book was this funny memoir, this parenting collection of parenting essays, "You're Not the Boss of Me." And I had a pretty solid reputation as a humor writer. And I come from three generations of comedy writers. I mean, it is what my family does. And so I wanted to tell the story of how I went to boarding school at 14 and I was a troubled mess of a girl. And then I sort of worked my way over 4 years of high school. And by the spring of my senior year, I had overcome so much. You know, I had really bonded with the school and the people in that community. I had become an A student. That school helped me discover my own mind and my own writing mind, my critical mind. I became a sort of a shit talker and a banterer and all my social skills got built there. And then 6 weeks before graduation, I was seduced by a music teacher, a married music teacher. Our affair lasted exactly 7 days before we were found out. We had had sex one time and we were found out, and the school told me that they could not legally expel me because I was legally their responsibility, but for the sake of everyone in the community, I should go because I was going to make everybody very uncomfortable. I was never allowed to talk to my parents about this. Whatever. I left the next morning. They packed me up and I left. And I went to live with the teacher.
It truly makes me nauseous.
It's really... And yet, let me tell you that...
It makes me nauseous. Real quick, why couldn't you speak with your parents?
They were... One was hither and the other was yon at the time, right? One was in Cape Cod, the other was in L.A., my parents were very hands off. And like, I don't know, it was a different time. I mean, it's just like, why wasn't I put on the phone with them and allowed to make this decision with their counsel? I don't know, but it didn't occur to me at the time. And it was a frightful misfire in every direction, you know. It was,
yeah, because I feel like and the readers will realize this when they read The Big Hurt out right now by Hatchett. I said it right, didn't I?
Hachette.
Oh, Hachette. Whatever.
Hachette.
Whatever.
It's a Hachette. Wow.
Everybody's going to say Hatchett, so fuck it.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, you'll see, you know, that like you said, Erica, you got into a lot of trouble. But a lot of that was because it's like your parents, your father was film critic Richard Schickel. Mm-hmm. And that's a very famous name from Time magazine.
Yeah.
As he wrote for that publication for years. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew Richard Schickel. I mean, sure. It was just a standard. I would read like the comic in the back of Time magazine, and then I'd read the film review or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
was your dad. So yeah. He was like this academic, you know, guy in the community, complete narcissist.
Total. Hopeless and narcissist.
He brings you up like by his side, wearing nice clothes and going to premieres and treating you, you know, asking your mm-hmm. opinion about art, and which is all very beautiful. But it's like there was no childhood, it seems, for you and your sister.
Yeah,
there's a passage in the book that talks about how your parents, when they had your sister, they left you and your little sister after only 6 months. So your little sister's 6 months. You're like a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And your family, your parents left.
Well, actually, that was right after I was born. My sister wasn't born yet. She came 3.5 years after me. But yeah, my parents went on a cruise. I was 6 months old and left me in charge of a German nanny. I have no memory of it, of course, because I was an infant. But my mother sort of casually mentioned this to me in adulthood, you know, like, oh, yeah, we did that because your father didn't want to be slowed down. Like he was a narcissist in the sense of like he just couldn't imagine the feelings of other people. He did not have that ability. Now, he was not a Trump level narcissist. He was not a hideously toxic, abusive narcissist. And out of my two parents, they were both narcissists. My mother was a terribly wounded narcissist. And my father was just the golden child, only child. So he came by his narcissism just through his upbringing. My mother, you know, really suffered some stuff as a young girl and a young woman that I never knew about. And some of it I didn't really understand until after she died. But of the two parents at that time of my life, my father was the better parent. He was mm-hmm. the more involved parent. He understood me and he advocated for me. And my mother turned me into her enemy when I reached puberty. And it was something about me, who I was, that triggered the shit out of her. And she kept giving me this power, like this power to hurt her. And, you know, I was a self-obsessed 14-year-old. I mean, I was surely an asshole. I mean, I was a 14-year-old girl, right? This is, we are all assholes at that age. Yes, I've had two and they sucked, you know. But, you know, I mean, part of the parenting job is to be like, okay, I'm going to choose love, you know, even though I'm being tested by this horrible person in my house. I'm choosing love and I'm going to believe in this child and keep them close because that's the job. And my mother did the opposite. She turned me into an enemy and she got rid of me.
Yeah. And so this is what I'm getting to. The point is here, here's what I'm getting to. Your father turns you into this really smart, sassy person. Mm-hmm. So you end up getting into a lot of trouble at the ages of 11, 12, 13. But then you go to this boarding school, 14. You're still in trouble, 15. But all of a sudden you turn it around in your junior year and you start really getting involved in a lot of different academic, a lot of different groups, a lot of different stuff's going on and you're really succeeding until – And so they're building you up. This this school, this boarding school called Buxton in upstate New York, right?
No, in Western Massachusetts, in the Berkshires.
Sorry, in Western Massachusetts. Those states up there, everything is so small and clustered. I just, you know.
Yeah, they're installed 20 minutes.
That's right. I'm just going to call it Hatchetbooks.
Yeah, call it Hatchetbooks.
Northeast. No, I'm going to call it that because that's what everybody else calls it, right? Like Northeast is just like, it's everything's upstate New York for me.
It's all smart.
And so, but you're at this school, Buxton, and they finally start building you up and you're feeling good. And it looks like you're really going to, you're on this path of almost like your dad's path, academia. And then all of a sudden this, because you're still a child, you're only 16.
When I was seduced, it was 2 months after my 18th birthday. I turned 18 in February. And it was April.
So this guy, this teacher, who is a married guy, his wife also works on campus, right? Mm-hmm. They were like the young, hip couple on campus.
Yep.
And he seduces you. He's 32?
Three, yep.
33. You're a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to leave the school.
Yeah.
He decides to leave too, or...
He's fired. He got fired. However, let me tell you this, that he was also at that time simultaneously teaching at Bennington College, which is just over the Vermont border, since we're talking about how squished together all that part of the country is. So he was teaching at Bennington. Did Buxton ever call Bennington to say, you have a predator on your staff? No, he went on to teach for many more years.
Yeah, they just pass it on.
They just, and it's, you know, in the Catholic Church, when they do that, it's called passing the trash. And that's what happens in private boarding schools, you know, or Boy Scout troops. I mean, it's the same story.
Anytime you drop your kid off or leave him go for 7 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks unsupervised, it's like, what are you doing? Anyway, so through the book, that's only part of the story. It's just part of your story. But it's so upsetting how you finally get things going in your life and they just slam you back down.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it just crashes and it's so cruel. It's so terribly cruel. And now your parents, instead of understanding themselves or getting themselves, giving some empathy, it just seems like they just, again, abandoned you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, on top of that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to say that, like, also, and a lot of this, and it's not a huge portion of the book that actually happens at boarding school, because what would happen is in the summers, instead of going home, they would send me away to do something else because they were having these very, my mother didn't want me around and my father was having his fabulous bi-coastal career and dating and doing stuff. So they kept sending me away. And when I was away, I was being stat raped by the people in charge of me at these very places. So I went on an outdoor adventure. I went on an Infinite Odyssey outdoor camping adventure in which I was stat raped by the rafting instructor or the kayaking instructor. I was sent off to do summer theater at the age of 16, where I was stat raped by one of the actors in the company.
Yeah. He comes in and says, come on into my pool.
Yeah. And what's so I just internalized. I mean, it was just the way the world was. Like, I imagine you're a teenage girl, and you know, first of all, the 70s were going on all around us. I mean, and I say in the book, I was, you know, a Jodie Foster lookalike, quite literally. I mean, I was like a willowy, I had very light blonde hair as a young girl, just savvy, street smart, thinks she knows
taxi
everything.
Taxi driver.
Yeah, taxi driver. And in this world, it was just a wild, and I went to the Dalton School, which has, you know, Donald Barr was his dad was the headmaster there, right? Bill Barr's father was the headmaster. And Jeffrey, oh my God, help me, I'm blanking his name. The guy
Epstein.
Thank you. Jeffrey Epstein was teaching math when I was there. While I was a student there, the Donald Barr allowed Louis Malle's casting team to come and walk the hallways and look in the classrooms for a young girl who might be able to play the lead, the child prostitute in Pretty Baby, which Brooke Shields later got. I was called in for an audition for that. My mother didn't let me go, one of her better choices. But, you know, it was that's what it was like. It was like girls were right. Fair game. So I never saw anything wrong with it. You know, it took me many years. And then so I would go away for the summer. I would become lonely and sexually abused. And then I would return to Buxton in the fall. And it was like I could remember who I was. Like I was like, oh yes, I'm writing papers and I'm starring in the play and I have friends and this is my world. So that's more context for what eventually happened.
Yeah. Okay. So you're going to talk today about being raised by wolves, but I do want to tell everybody the big hurt, you know, it goes into, you know, all of this abuse happens when you're younger and it never gets talked about. Yeah. And, you know, your father, he would write you these long, complicated letters. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm thinking, who was he talking to? He wrote you letters like you were his, you know, a professor at the university.
I know.
What was that all about? Just because he's so bright?
We are a family of fucking letter writers. I mean, I don't know how to explain it, except that is what my people do, you know? I mean, literally, and I talk about this in the book a tiny, I mean, I just mentioned this, like the generations of writing is what my family does, which is why I tried to be an actor for many, many years before I finally succumbed to the family curse. But I mean, going back to generations. I mean, it's poets, it's preachers, it's academics, it's television, radio writers, you know. So a long letter from your parent wasn't that shocking to me. Again, all of this was just my normal, you know. And really what I want to say about this story and about writing this book, having read Being Raised by Wolves, and many of you and your listeners who are Gen Xers are going to go, oh yeah, well, sure. You know, I mean, it's so different now than it was then. So I had this story about what happened to me in high school. And I was still, when I started writing the book, I was still a comedy writer in my head, right? And I thought I was going to write this hilarious romp through a bohemian boarding school in the 70s, you know, and it would all be like smoking weed out of apple pipes in the woods and like sneaking out of the dorms and playing pranks and oh, the hilarity and the fun, which was actually true. There was hilarity and fun at that school. And then, whoops, at the very end, I got seduced by a teacher and kicked out. And I was going to make that the sort of gasp-worthy ending, right, of whatever this fucking book was. And I was calling it Unsupervised at the time. And then I got an opportunity to go to Hedgebrook, this writing retreat. And I got on the plane to go, and a friend of mine had said, read Joyce Maynard's memoir, At Home in the World, which is about her affair with J.D. Salinger. She was a student at Yale, just a young woman. And she had written a thing that was on a New York Times Sunday magazine. And it was sort of like a world-weary take from a 20-year-old. A 20-year-old looks back on life. It was sort of a tongue-in-cheek, whatever. And Salinger saw this and started writing to her. Began an epistolary love affair with her. And she ended up dropping out of Yale and going to live with him in his cabin in Cornish, New Hampshire. And so I'm reading this book, and this was before I had started, blew up my marriage for an affair with an inappropriate pedagogic male, right?
Okay, wait. So now in the book, I wanted to mention that I had to look up about 12 words. And now you put two on the list. What did you just say?
Pedagogic means a person who, a teacher, an instructor, a person of authority who,
Okay, now go back to the sentence before. You said what did you say? It was an adjective.
Oh.
Expediosary or something.
I don't know. It flies out of my face so fast.
All right. I will say this. You have such a vocabulary, Erica. You really do. And all the words are so appropriate. You choose great words. But, look, I didn't know a lot of them. I'm just saying.
Well, hopefully, I don't try to sit on top of big words because I just find that some of the big words work better than the other words.
Yes.
But I'm also a big fan of using words that don't exist. There are all kinds of words in this book where when we were doing the audiobook, my engineer was like, "What is that word?" And I was like, that's just my word for the thing, So,
that's
funny. Language is all purpose to me.
So basically you duplicate some of these problems that happen in your teenage years, in your adult years, when you have a husband and you have children, and all of a sudden you're off as this guy's muse. And his name is Sam Spade in the book, and everybody knows it's just a placement of a name.
Yeah.
So are you or are you not revealing this writer? Because it's actually not hard to find
out. It's not hard to find out. It's a quick Google, and it was James Ellroy, the crime writer. So, which is the reason that's so hard, so easy to figure out. And the reason why I named him Sam Spade is because it is one Google click away. Because while we were together, he talked about me in the press constantly.
You were right by his side.
I was by his side.
So that's that.
But this actually is part of the story, the Raised by Wolves story. I'm sort of getting to it, because what happened was, I was reading Joyce Maynard's book, and it wasn't the Salinger stuff that got to me. It was the stuff about her mom, Friedel, that sort of cracked me wide open. I was reading about this woman. It was so like my mother. And suddenly, I start crying on the plane. I land. I get to this little cottage in the woods where I'm to be alone for 3 weeks, except for at dinner time. And it was like I fell apart in this cottage, and I started crying, and I could not stop for 3 weeks. And it was just it opened up what had happened. And I suddenly realized that my mother had abandoned me. And it's so obvious to anybody now, but I was 45 years old before I understood that. And then I understood that my father had too, and that the Buxton School had, and that every single adult who was responsible for me had completely thrown me away. And at that time, I had two daughters who were nearing the age I was when all of this started up for me. So I became so deeply, so heartbroken about it. And it was terrifying. It was just it was so much to handle. And even the teacher who eventually threw me away, which was the final great betrayal from that story, he doesn't matter. What was emotionally resonant was that I had been orphaned essentially by my family. And also, parenthetically, I have a sister who I was separated from. I never really, we were sibling assholes when we were little kids, right? We fought over the backseat in the car or whatever. And then, once I got to adolescence, I was gone. And I didn't discover my little sister until we were in our 20s. And then I realized this was going to be one of my dearest friends for the rest of my life, that we had experienced all the same things. We had all the same references. We had a lot of the same damage. And so she's been my dearest nuclear family member. But anyway,
has she ever written about her experience?
She's a phenomenal writer. Such a good writer. And she has done some writing, and she had a blog for a while. And she's much more in the vein of the comedy writer, the family comedy thing. I mean, she's a hilarious writer. But she's not, she hasn't published anything. You know, she doesn't have books or anything. But I hope that that will change.
So at this point in your life, because I kind of want to just keep this conversation going, because the whole conversation is about being raised by wolves.
Yeah.
And you guys, I want to just throw in that you can find Erica over at her website, ericashickle.com. I'm going to spell it because I'm a giver. ericashickle.com. And also follow her on Twitter, again, at Erica Schickel, ericashickel. So what you're describing is you are realizing that, you know, you have two daughters coming up to the same age you were. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm sorry. So in the cottage, the 3-week experience in that cottage, that was like a gift. Am I right?
I mean yes. I mean, it was unbearable, but it was a gift. Yeah. But it changed everything for me. You know, I came home from that going, I can't write this book. You know, I don't know what the story is. And the story was so dark to me that what I did, and I know this now, but at the time I had, this was not a conscious choice. But at that time I had met Elroy at a book festival. I had met him twice, actually, and both encounters are sort of right at the beginning of the book. I met this man who I'd never read a book of his. I had no interest in him at all until I met him. And I met him, and he was a very odd bird. But yet I had this feeling of like, oh my God, I know this person. This is my person. This is a kindred spirit. Like, and if he knew who I really was, he would come right over here and get me. Like, this is a thing. He didn't know it. And I put him in the back of my mind for 2 years. I sort of toyed with him imaginatively.
I
manifested this fucked up, crazy relationship. And then finally, in 2009, I friended him on Facebook, of course, of all places. And that's what sort of began the second great epistolary love affair of my life.
There's the word.
Epistolary. It's a letter writing affair. Affair conducted through letters. So he would write, we were writing to each other every day. And so what I ended up doing is using him as a way to work out my past. Like, I couldn't do it in my head. And again, this was all subconscious. You know, now I see it, but then I didn't. And it's called repetition compulsion. There's an actual term for it, where we do things that make us re-experience the original trauma so that we can...
Trying to get a better outcome.
Fucking resolve it. Yeah. And get a better... Now, I did not get a better outcome with this affair, but it really, you know, it forced me to reckon with myself and with my past.
It's sort of common when you think of, just because I've gone out with the older guy thing. I've done that like mm-hmm. 4 times in my life, like 18 years older, 15 years older, 15 years older. Mm-hmm. And then my ex-husband was 12 years mm-hmm. older. And so I've done that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, sucks, but it's exactly repeating, you know, that my dad left when I was 15 mm-hmm. and somebody got to take care of me. And so it just went on over and over and over again. It's really sad.
And when you are a beautiful young girl, unsupervised in the world, you know, men become like the romantic attachment for me was the closest thing I could get to love, intimacy, and feeling seen. And I was being seen because I was hot, right? You know, I was being seen because I was a Lolita. But I could not see that. I just thought, that I was being loved, you know. And of course, every time I would be tossed aside because that's not what any of those men wanted from me. So, you know, that, I mean, people will ask, well, why would you do that? And it was like, that was my best option at the time. I was a willing participant in the affair that led to my being kicked out of school. I believed that he was in love with me. I wasn't sure if I was in love with him because it went so fast and I was so screwed up. I didn't even know what love was. But I believed that he was in love with me and that this was my best chance for being taken care of.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I know very well. Yeah. I know this.
Yeah.
And so now as an adult, you repeat this behavior or this codependent cycle with a guy, you know, this mystery writer who you call Sam Spade in the book, but like you said, is actually a mystery writer, James Ellroy. There's pictures of you guys together at events and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, he's like the guy. I mean, it's like everybody knows, even if you Wikipedia the guy, it'll be like, you know, he's a recluse or, you know, he's the mysterious himself or he's this or that. But really, he's cold and calculating and a narcissist. And he made you his fucking, I don't know.
I was her, in quotes. I was his immortal beloved. So it was a very, I mean, you know, cold and calculating. No, I mean, in the end, cold and calculating. But at first, I mean, the love bombing was epic.
How much older was he than you?
He was 16 years older than me.
Okay, so I guess it's not that much.
And when you're in middle age, who gives a shit,
yeah,
right?
I
mean, basically.
But I know. But at the same time, he was treating you like you were 25.
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, it's not really that clear cut with him. I mean, and I actually have to, it's really hard for me to talk about that relationship because I still love the man. I mean, I'm not romantically in love with him anymore at all, but you know, I still hold tenderness for him. You know, he is not in fact a bad person, but he is an extraordinarily damaged person. I, for those who don't know who he is, he wrote L.A. Confidential and The Black Dahlia and scores of other books. And his mother was murdered when he was 10 years old. Famously murdered, and the killer was never found. So that shaped him, obviously, as one might imagine. I mean, he's been dining out on it for his entire career, but the damage is true and genuine. And also his mother sucked before he died. I mean, he had terrible, terrible parents. Terrible parents. So as somebody who had terrible parents and who's made mistakes and had to deal with their issues from bad parenting, I do hold space for people who have gone through terrible, you know, childhood experiences. Where his madness was literally manifested in just fear and panic attacks. So when he wasn't triggered, he was reasonable, he was kind, he was generous, he was cool-headed, he was very good at seeing me, reading me, helping me understand my life, my story, my parents. He's a really brilliant man, but his Achilles heel is that he gets triggered and he becomes an insane fucking lunatic. And it prevents him from having real relationships with women and, you know, and from being happy. I mean, and it makes him hurt people.
And so can you give us an example of, you know, his lunacy? Was it always like kind of a triggered by, you know, like, was it like a doorknob thing or, you know what I mean?
It was any sense that he had of any, he was convinced that I was the most beautiful woman in the world, and that every single man who saw me wanted to fuck me, which made being out in the world with me impossible. So as long as we were home in our little safe den, we were okay. But he couldn't watch things on television that would trigger him. Like if there was we were watching TV and there was a man in swim trunks, he would cover my eyes. If there was dancing, like even ballroom dancing, he would cover my eyes. Like anything, because he thought that I was susceptible and sort of susceptible to sensuality, which of course I am. You know, I'm a human being, but, you know, I know how to regulate that.
Yeah, but how could you think that he understood you when he wouldn't even let you dance?
I mean, it's the great, if ask anybody who has been in love with a Jekyll and Hyde, which is what it was. It was a Jekyll and Hyde. And, you know, you love the good man and you despise the bad one. And in the end, the bad one takes over. And for him, you know, he was just using me in this sort of pattern that he had with women of, you know, putting them on a pedestal and then knocking them down, you know. And with me,
how many times do you think he did this?
All his life he's done it. All his life. And he wanted to do it with me, except that the problem was that I was shaped to be a clinger, right? I've been so shaped by abandonment that I will do almost anything to prevent my loved one, whether that's a lover or a friend, from leaving me. Like withdrawing their love from me is the worst thing that can happen to me. I mean, I'm working on it and it's less bad now, but I wouldn't let him leave. And I saved his life a couple of times. I kept hanging in there, even though it was insane for me to be doing that. This is not a strong woman reclaiming herself story necessarily, you know? And towards the end of the story, I actually say, I would like to tell you now that I'd like to be able to tell you that I got the clue and I left. I walked out. But that's not what happened. He finally walked away from me. But his pattern was to outrage women to the point where they would dump him so that he could be free to do the next thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it really is typical narcissistic behavior.
Classic.
Yeah, and in terms of him always having to have that stimulation, it was always about him. It was
always
about him. You could have been, it's so sad, but you could have been really anybody.
I could have been, and this is sort of
But
this,
he probably loved, though, that your father was kind of famous, and you did
that.
Come from that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you come from that Buxton world of, you know, upscale New York or whatever.
But this is,
and so that would fit in with him in his life.
This is kind of the nature of why I'm this story. And what I come away with is, like, you know, for us women, girls and women who get sucked into these kinds of relationships, abusive relationships, who we are, I mean, what we appear to be is everything. So we need to be beautiful. We need to be educated. We need to be articulate. We need to be savvy and snappy and well-dressed and turned out and good in bed. But whatever we are beyond those qualities is of no matter to these people. And when we start becoming real with all of our insecurities and our foibles and our, you know, bad hair days and whatever the fuck is going on, because we're human, like there's no place for that. It doesn't. We are mirrors. We are here to reflect the male genius in this situation.
And isn't it interesting how this could be at any level of money?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way you say it, but in other words, it's not because he was rich and you needed the money, because you were doing fine. You have your family. You had your girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not. This definitely crosses all economic boundaries when this happens.
Yeah.
And just tell me again why you don't think it's like a hashtag Me Too thing. Before we started recording, you said something about, you know, you don't want to really associate it with hashtag Me Too.
Yeah. But hashtag Me Too. I mean, no, I'm not digging on the hashtag at all, you know, and thank God for the Me Too movement. I feel like hashtag Me Too is becoming a shortcut for people to stop being interested in what you're talking about, in the details of the story. So, you know, and I think that there's some backlash, and I certainly don't want to be a part of that. I want the Me Too movement to keep rolling on until predators are no longer free to predate upon children and young women. But yeah, I mean, I sense a sort of cultural dimming of interest in the Me Too story, you know?
Well, do you have another idea, another proposal for, you know, the next catchphrase?
No, I really don't.
Yeah, but I mean, now if you hashtag Me Too, you know, you will get that subject and that if you need those resources.
Oh, and
then
I
you
use the hashtag so that I can, yeah. No, I do. I do.
Do you have another idea? Hashtag.
Yeah.
Fuck off.
Fuck off, you fucking predators. I don't know. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think there's a better hashtag than Me Too, you know? And just like in this interview, you sitting there going, oh, God, me too. You know, you have your stories to tell from your own background. I mean, we all do. And my story is only unique in its details. You know, I mean, it's unique in that the setting was crazy. You know, I grew up in a very sort of rarefied. I did not grow up wealthy, just to correct you, your earlier statement. I mean, I was upper middle class in the 1970s, which means my father supported the family by being a film critic and a freelance writer. I mean, every penny was hammered out of his typewriter. There was no family wealth.
Okay, I think you're correct, and obviously you're correct, but I should rephrase it. Sorry, I'm sniffling. I should rephrase it. You grew up in an artistic way in a city. How do I say that? You grew up, in other words, I didn't even know half of what you grew up knowing was even existed. I didn't know it was tangible to write for a newspaper. I didn't know it was tangible to go to a film premiere. I never met a star. You know, your father would write you letters and he'd say, look, Erica, we've decided that you're going to leave this school, or Erica, you're going to do this or that. Yeah. And I even talked to Clint Eastwood about it.
Yes. He would do that. It was just.
So what is the world then? I'm trying to say you grew up in such a cultured.
I was raised by the cultural elite. Really, that's what it was. It wasn't money elite. It was culture elite. So meaning, you know, screenings and celebrities and everybody's, you know, reading each other's books.
Art
and
galleries.
All of the stuff that was had. All of that stuff. Yeah, I learned to walk in the Metropolitan Museum of Art because my mother would let me loose in those big wide galleries and it was safe. I could just toddle around without getting into trouble. So, you know, I mean, that was,
I would love to see a picture of that.
I don't have a picture of me in the museum.
Seriously. Couldn't you see that though? No, as a child, right? Wouldn't that be a lovely,
like
a black and white shot? Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. That's a neat memory.
I'm actually doing a series of little book posts with quotes from the book and paired with these beautiful black and white photographs that my father took while we were growing up. I'm starting to launch those. He took amazing
pictures.
That's
such a great idea.
But I just wanted to go back to saying how, you know, in terms of the story, because this is story worthy, you know, the story turned on me. Like I said, I thought I was writing this funny little memoir and it turned out to be called The Big Hurt. I mean, it turned out suddenly I was writing the saddest book in the world, you know, and it was a strange experience of just like, my life and this book are going in a direction I don't really want to go in, but I'm going to try to keep writing while it happens. So this book took me 12 years to write because so much of it that's in the book, I was living as I was trying to write the book. And I began the affair with Elroy I began a friendship with him because he was going to help me figure out how to get this huge sprawling story organized into a narrative. And I just didn't understand the narrative of my life. And one of the things he was a master of was understanding the narrative of his life. And, you know, he's written two memoirs. He's, you know, he's good at that. He does big, complicated books. So I was like, teach me, oh master. And then he was like, I'm just going to teach you about the shape of my dick instead. But, you know.
That's a real summation of the story.
I was like, help me. God, I don't know how to write this book. Can you help me? You know.
And meanwhile, he's the he's part of the story.
He becomes part
it's
of the story.
It's just like, I just can't, I can't recommend this book enough to my audience. And but we got to wrap it up because we're almost there. But I want to read you, you know, I think this is like the second page. By the way, I've got like 25 notes in here that I didn't even get to talk to you about. So, but here's one. Here's one I knew I was going to love this book. The electric crackle over the building's internet evoked a Pavlovian response in my cunt. Jesus Christ. I was like, I am so in on this book. Yeah. That's like the second page. And you're talking about going to see your lover in his apartment here in Larchmont, California, mm-hmm. which is right by Paramount Studios. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Ravenwood.
The Ravenswood, yeah.
Ravenswood. And I think it's famous for –
God. What is her name? Wow, Delia, peel me a grape.
Mae West.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it just has this iconic sign. Anytime you mm-hmm. see a picture of like the flatland in Hollywood, you're going to see all those signs and you're going to see the Capitol Records building and you're going to see, it's really cool, the signs. And it says Ravenswood and it's so, it just stands there. And I can't even imagine the stories.
Oh, so that building.
You know,
is so,
haunt that place.
It's a great building.
Oh, my God. That's got to be a movie, just a movie called Ravenswood.
Well, I have added a chapter to the Ravenwood's famous story.
You sure have, Erica. Thank you so much. You guys, get over there. Buy The Big Hurt. Buy it at your local bookstore. Or, of course, I always suggest that you buy it at Skylight Books. .com. Erica, good luck with your book tour and your launch.
You.
I mean, this is, I think, I swear to God, I believe you are an inspiration to a lot of girls who have had, myself included, who have had almost too much to untangle. It's almost too much to believe is what it is.
Yeah,
and my story is similar. It's almost too fucking much to believe.
I know. I'm so sorry. And I send so much love to you and to all those girls out there who are trying to struggle and sort out the confusing experiences that they've lived through. And not everybody has the outlet of writing. And, you know, I hope that this book is, you know, my hope for this book, the meta hope, was that my reader at the end of the book would hold the book and look at it and go, I'm holding the happy ending of this story, which is that I finally was able to finish writing the story.
Look at the chills on my arm. Oh. I absolutely agree. I really do. And I want to also say there was one quote that made me laugh from Sandra Tsinglo, and I she's also one of my favorite authors as well. But anyway, Sandra says something like, this is one of the top five books I've ever read, and I don't remember the other four.
Yeah.
Wow. And then she goes, wowee. And it's true. That's all I could say about this book, too. It's just like, fuck, wow. It's The Big Hurt. It's like the biggest hurt, and it is just fabulous. So congratulations again.
Thank you, Christine.
All right, you guys, got to wrap it up. But listen, head over to Twitter and follow Erica Schickel, at Erica Schickel. And then follow me over there as well, at Storyworthy. And stay connected, would you, please? Yes?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, you guys, one more time, on behalf of the fabulous author, Erica Schickel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Christine. Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.